My name's David Clues. I'm the lead correspondent at UNN, and I started UNN just nearly 7 years ago with my colleague Carol Pearson, who's moved on to some other things now. I've been involved in politics for a long time. I've done lots of different jobs. I've done a few different things. I was an elected councillor a long, long time ago, back in 2007. So as I said, I've been on a sort of political journey, as many people do. In about 2016, there was the Brexit vote. And I mean, I wasn't overly like pro-Brexit. I mean, I felt that leaving the EU was the right thing to do. And the reason I thought it was the right thing to do was just because the intransigence showed by the likes of Angela Merkel, the inability, like Cameron said he would get a deal. And then after that happened, I started noticing, like 2016, that the media were basically going to try and stop it from happening. And I thought, hey, this is a bit unfair. So genuinely, when UNN was founded, if you watched us then, we were a bit like GB News is now. We were like, you know, waving the union flag. That's still the old logo I've got there. And I'm not saying that was a bad thing, but, you know, we were kind of appealing to that sort of traditional and like people who were former Conservatives, but they'd maybe moved on to UKIP. They'd maybe moved a bit further to the right, or maybe the Tory party had moved further to the left. And that was our standard audience. And then all of it, but in reality, the last 7 years there's been a few things happened, I think it's fair to say, Tony.
Yeah. What about, I mean, this whole thing of left and right? Because I mean, I, as a socialist, old school sort of, I suppose, Benite style, have just seen everybody that was against rule by Brussels wanting a bit of a rule by somebody who was a bit closer to home. The whole entire anyone from the left who was into that was called a far right. You know, that's this right. Is something very bizarre going on with this whole thing of left right. It seems to me to be not like kind of history, basically.
It's very inorganic. I mean, again, like where I am now, I am a very different person. Not person, I'm still the same person, but my thinking has evolved over the last 5 years. And really the pivotal change for that was the COVID scam and what happened in March 2020 and the way the government behaved nationally, the way the media behaved and the way the political class behaved. And after that, there was really, that was the Rubicon cross. There was no going back. And as you say, the whole sort of left-right thing, it doesn't really exist anymore. It's nonsense. It's garbage. Clearly, there is so much overlap between different people and different ideas that I think the days of the whole left-right divide are gone now. And that's the hard part for the political class, because it's no longer BBC One and ITV. It's no longer Labour or Tory, red or blue. There are a lot of different shades. The choice is there and the shades are there now.
What about Scottish independence?
Well, I'm against Scottish independence just intrinsically because I believe in the nation state of the United Kingdom. I believe in our shared history. And I also believe that what they are offering isn't really independence. What they're offering is more NATO, more European Union. And in any globalised world with Vanguard and BlackRock, I mean, BlackRock, what, $11 trillion under management? I mean, what's, say, the whole of Scotland's worth, what, a few hundred billion? I mean, BlackRock could just buy you and ruin your country. So the idea of independence isn't, they're not offering independence, they're just offering a different managerial structure. But if I was actually talking about that the other night on my show, if the Scottish government turned around and said, look, we're going to put all the woke stuff away, we're not going to join NATO, we're not going to join the EU, but we'll have a good relationship with them, we won't support any wars, we'll restore our borders, we'll crank up the oil and gas again, or we'll be an energy independent country, I think they would win a referendum on it. I wouldn't support it, but I think they would win, and I don't think it would be the end of the world.
What about you touching there on, because the Scots are famous for their North Sea oil. What do you make of energy policy? Because we've got the Scottish Greens. I noticed that they're calling for the extension of the life of the nuclear power stations. This to me doesn't really well, it certainly is not traditionally environmentally friendly at all.
I mean, energy policy, I think, is completely ludicrous. Scotland does have a lot of oil and gas reserves, but they're not allowed to tap into them. Then, as you say, the Greens with the nuclear power. I mean, I always just take the opposite view of the government. And they are clearly pushing net zero. They are clearly pushing what they call renewable energy. I just don't really think it's economically viable at all. And a big thing in Scotland they did was hydroelectric. You know, I'm not against using things like hydroelectric. That was very successful, wave power and things like that. But I think their energy policy is ludicrous.
And I know we've got in England, we've got Drax, the old coal-fired power station, burning forests literally from, you know, new virgin forest as well as summer.
Yeah, I'm against that.
But I mean, the Scots are doing the same. You know, I remember reading that when these government subsidised biofuel power plants were opened up, there's several across Scotland. That the forestry industry was up in arms, saying, well, actually, there's not enough trees growing in Scotland to feed these stations. So what you're going to do is you're just going to destroy the timber industry. So that's why they've had to decide they're going to import this from America.
Yeah. You see, the other thing is as well, I am not a neoliberal. I'm not a Thatcherite. I mean, I do believe in sustainability and I do believe in living in harmony with nature. And I hate to see deforestation. I hate to see all these things. Like, if someone could prove to me that the renewable energy they're pushing was better for the environment, then I would support it. But I actually think it doesn't. The way you would stop that is consumption. You actually do need to cut down on consumption. But the entire UK economy is built on increased consumption of goods, increased people, so they have to have a pyramid scheme of mass immigration. Like, it's you will not stop the energy usage unless you just cut back on consumption. And that's the thing, is people talk a good game on the environment, but unless people were actually prepared to look at consumption, you're just, excuse my language, you're pissing in the wind.
Well, look, you've got the situation in Ireland now where there's so many of these data centers because of the tax rate there. They're actually starting to run out. Well, they are having to massively build power stations to feed these data centers. Not only that, is you've got the absolute obsession with mobile data that uses something like 1,000 times more energy than the old fashioned fiber optics and this sort of thing. So there seems to be it hardwired into the policy, a massive increase in energy consumption. Then the idea is you're going to get rid of things like the diesel engine, diesel trains, everything's going to go electric. So more energy.
That's right. You actually need to produce more energy to fund the electric power and the power that goes into it. Yeah, none of it adds up at all. And then, I'm sure you'll know the whole CO2 scam, that it's carbon dioxide. I mean, the numbers just don't add up in the cold light of day. But I do think excessive materialism and commercialism is damaging to society, yet no politician would ever actually address that.
I mean, we've seen these new figures out about HS2 over the holidays. I remember there was an independent expert group, gosh, must be about 4 years ago, saying they think it's going to be 111 billion it's going to cost. We've seen the doubling of the cost of Hinkley C, the nuclear power station down near us in Somerset, from 25 billion up to 50 billion now. And still, the end point always seems to be receding when it's going to be actually delivering any power. So, I mean, it's all a pretty gloomy prospect. I know one of the things you do is you're picking up on news stories from day to day as well. We're not just looking at the bigger. This is what the mainstream legacy media has failed to do, is to give a bigger picture on everyday events, really. And so we got the honours list and Stephen Fry being given his award.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Stephen Fry, if I'm being honest with you. Stephen Fry is establishment through and through, does all the voiceovers for Sainsbury's, etc. as well. Very questionable past. he's written some very questionable plays in the past as well. And I mean, yeah, Stephen Fry seemed much more concerned about supposed anti-Semitism than he was about mass slaughter of innocent people. So that's why he's getting the award, I think.
Yeah, it was 23 Christmas. I couldn't find some decent Christmas messages this year. But when Alexei Sayle was so disgusted with Stephen Fry's alternative Christmas message, he did his own one, which was rather better. But, I mean, Fry is an interesting character in that I know for a fact that he's extremely powerful in the media industry. And a lot of people look to him as a sort of unofficial commissioning editor for drama and the arts and mm-hmm. even game shows, you know. So he's got a lot of power. What about, you know, this? His plays? You're talking about slightly dodgy plays. What are they?
Well, that was a play. Let me actually try and get you the name because I can't actually remember it. That he wrote when he was a younger man about a schoolmaster. It was, let me tell you exactly what it was called. Something to do with tobacco, but it was this tale of a homosexual relationship between a Latin master and his 13-year-old pupil. It was done back in 2002 at the Edinburgh Fringe, and the paedophile schoolmaster then engages in sexual relations with other pupils as well, and they then go off and abscond together to Morocco in the end. So interesting subject choice from Mr. Fry.
It is. And also, I mean, he's got a relationship with a much younger man. I don't think in a way, you know, the gay part of it isn't so important. I think we're all aware of the way that wealthy, powerful, elderly people can prey on younger ones.
Very much so. And there is an agenda being pushed there clearly, and it is involving, you know, younger men, and it is very predatory in behavior. You're dealing with younger people who don't have perhaps money. These are people who are looking for a start in life, and if you've got an elder statesman, they're prepared to give a helping hand, both literally and figuratively, and the television and film industry is notorious for that, where powerful people use their position to exploit others. And there is a double standard there, because clearly if it was a man doing it to a woman, then they would be called out, they would be the worst person in the world. But if it's a man doing it to a younger male, then everybody seems to just not have an issue with that.
I mean, there seems to be almost a taboo in the mainstream press about this sort of topic. So the idea of the family is sort of old-fashioned, it's outmoded, outdated. What do you make of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly there is an attempt by the mainstream media and others and a much bigger picture to attack a happy family and a family unit that exists, and clearly this is an agenda that has been going on for a very, very, very long time. You know, the normalization and pushing of divorce, that parents are bad to their children, that it is very insidious, and a lot of that is pushed.
Anything about this, David, is the way that it's become totally normalized that both parents have to be out at work. Yeah. Looking at the situation now, it's almost, even though both parents might be out of work, that they can't actually afford to pay a mortgage, even on that sort of salary, and own their own home. And what this has done, of course, is it's driven right from a very early age, even nursery, the kids out into sort of professional care of one sort or another, so this relationship between the mother bringing up the children, it's become the nursery nurses and strangers that are bringing kids up. It's almost like you've been sent to boarding school when you're only like 2 or 3 years old or something.
Yeah, so, I mean, the numbers just don't add up now. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. They've screwed the system where young people it's impossible for them to buy a house. Renting costs an absolute fortune. Then to start a family, they are barely able to look after themselves. The numbers just don't add up. And that's why you've got a birth rate that's collapsed. That's why you have a situation where people are just, there is a nihilism that's gripping the country. And again, even if you look at what were called supposed totalitarian regimes, even they recognize that people needed affordable housing and they needed a place of work that was within, you know, decent distance. You know, that's a big thing in the southeast of England, perhaps not as much up here. The commute where people are traveling like 3 hours a day, I mean, that's not life. It's utterly soulless.
Well, I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all, does it? It's as if this complete change in the way that we work and travel, and the massive amounts of energy it's taking up, fuel, etc., pollution, whatever.
I am not massively ideological, but I actually say this. Even if you look at say Soviet bloc or Soviet aligned countries, say Poland, Romania, etc., during what they would call the worst devastating impact of communism, their birth rate remained steady, people still had jobs, and there was very little crime. and you know, look at them now. Like, look at Poland. Poland was remained a solid Catholic conservative country. Now it's divorce everywhere. Nobody, like hardly anyone goes to church now. That is what, you know, neoliberal Western economics does to countries. It's like the watch in front of you. It shows you the shiny thing and people look wow, but the long-term effects are devastating.
Yeah, you're right. Looking at the way that, you know, after the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, a lot of those Eastern European countries had been listening to British music or US music, and maybe watching and seeing some films, TV, this sort of thing, coming from the West, thinking, crikey, you know, we really want to live like that. In fact, I think, there were millions of Eastern Europeans that were really looking forward to being released from communism and joining the West, and then they found actually, so it's exploitative, it's decadent. But anyway, look, over Christmas we've had this whole intervention by Elon Musk on Twitter. Now, I mean, you know, this is just a few tweets, but this guy is going to be quite influential in the new government, in the new empire, the new emperor, Trump, who's about to be inaugurated. And I suppose that it is quite reasonable for the press nationally to be looking at this. Although, of course, there's hardly any news over the Christmas period. So this is kind of...
Well, I mean, that's exactly right. That's the time to command the agenda, isn't it? And it was like a lot of people said at the time, well, you know, Elon's... $44 billion for Twitter, what a waste of money. Well, $44 billion and you can basically influence elections and around the world, you know, it's pocket change. You know, Twitter from that regard would be worth, you know, $4.4 trillion. I mean, I think it's important to say that around the rape gangs and what took place, the anger around it is justified. These gangs were, what happened was covered up. It was covered up by the Labour Party. The media did cover it, but perhaps not to the extent they should. And they it was covered up because people were trying to maintain the multicultural dream. And, you know, even a lot of people have said this by not dealing with it, it has destroyed any notion of living in a multicultural society. But what I've been pointing out is the people that are showing interest in it now, they're not really showing interest in it because they're sad about Britain or what happened to these girls. There's a bigger play going on. And, you know, you've got people like Barry Weiss, who is a female, she calls herself a journalist. I mean, she's a Mossad spy, and now she's pontificating about rape gangs. And it is just very disingenuous because, you know, we saw the situations in the prisons in Israel where the Israeli prison guards are raping Palestinian men and boys, and like they're not talking about that. So what I'm just trying to say to people is, look, the anger is real, the anger is justified, it's good that it's being publicized, but what's the bigger picture? Like, is the richest man in the world really, you know, is he out batting for you?
Well, no, he's not. No, he's what he's doing is he's trying to intervene on this issue because he knows it's a thorny subject. And also he's backing Tommy Robinson, who's also David Miller has shown very clearly is working for the Zionists, for the genocidalists. So there's that side.
I mean, that's the other thing is as well is when you're taking money from these people, there are strings attached to it. And Robinson has worked for Rebel News, the David Horowitz Foundation, the Shulman Institute, just like Katie Hopkins. All these people are paid to co-opt anger to further the Zionist agenda. And I mean, again, from a very simplistic perspective, it's like, oh, look, we're in Israel. We're fighting these genocidal Muslims, Hamas. Oh, you guys have got Muslims there as well. All right, and they're raping your children. Well, you need to support us to now eliminate these Palestinians and then, you know, we're going to go and attack Iran. It's actually very simplistic, but people just can't seem to see that bigger picture.
No. Well, I don't know. I think I don't know how much this stuff really, how much traction it really gets. Anyway, look, let's just turn to the Middle East and to Ukraine, because got Dr. Trump coming in. I think there's a genuine sense of extreme nervousness about, I mean, he's now talking about taking over Panama, taking over Greenland.
That's incredible, isn't it?
That wasn't his pitch, an initial pitch, as far as I remember. I think he sort of mentioned it in a jokey way, but you've now got a different kind of alignment in the Middle East where he's saying basically he's going to force peace on these people. Now, of course, as we know, depending on how you try to force that peace, that could make things worse.
Yeah. I mean, I think it all comes down to what wishing this to create a greater Israel project. I think that's the big one. But as I often point out, even within factions, there are warring elements. So whilst the US is clearly run along Zionist interests, there are different factions within that. There is one faction that has a lot of antipathy to Russia and Putin and what he did, and they want a war with Ukraine. And then there's the other more Likud Netanyahu faction that wants the war with Iran. So, I mean, basically, we're just kind of sitting back watching it and it just seeing how it all plays out and which faction wins. But I mean, again, Elon Musk, he's very involved with Palantir. Palantir is intrinsically linked to the military industrial complex. There's a lot of money to be made in these wars.
Yeah, he's also been experimenting, and they've been doing live trial killings using Palantir of Russians over in Ukraine. Right. But it's still quite handy.
And Gaza, like, they were using AI to kill people in Gaza as well. I mean, it's horrific.
Yeah, so it's almost like Northern Ireland, which was a kind of training exercise for the big one. I want you to do a bit of crystal ball gazing. I know it's not totally unfair, but what do you think is going to be happening with those two conflicts?
Well, I mean, Trump did say he would end the Ukraine conflict within 24 hours. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. I don't know how he's going to play that out. Whether I think it might just keep rumbling on. I think maybe he just won't be as supportive as Biden, but they'll keep providing money and they'll keep providing weapons. And I've said the only way that the war in Ukraine is going to be won is with a Russian victory. The war would be ended is with a Russian victory. And, you know, I also have questions around Putin and the way in which that war has been allowed to drag on for as long as it has as well. I mean, it's going on 3 years now. It's ridiculous. I don't know why they allow this to continue. So it might just drag on, the war in Ukraine. In terms of war with Iran, yeah, I mean, that's the goal. They want rid of Iran. They want rid of the Islamic Republic. But Israel can't do it on their own. They would need American troops on the ground. Now, the question is, say they did apply a bit of pressure, say some B-52 bombers started appearing over the skies of Tehran, would you see like a Bashar Assad situation? Could the Iranian government just crumble overnight? Maybe. Or they could put up an incredible resistance. I just don't know, Tony.
On the sort of bigger picture here in the UK, I think it's obvious for most people that we need to have a big change so that when we vote, it actually means something. at the moment, it doesn't seem to, because the government doesn't really control any of the infrastructure. You know, they're talking about bringing the railways back into public ownership. But even so, the companies that own the trains, the Roscoes, the rolling stock companies, still cream off massive profits from the railways. But that's just one part of the infrastructure. How do you see a actual positive change? I'm not saying this is going to happen under Starmer at all. And if you can weave into that, there's this massive dispute that is brewing with the farmers. So can you give us a sort of positive vision for the UK? you can dream of such a thing that doesn't include Farmageddon.
It's a tough one because, I mean, it's quite funny because you go back to what Corbyn offered. You know, Corbyn wanted to borrow a few hundred billion and change things, and the Tories said, "Oh, don't vote for him. You'll have immigration running at 750,000 net a year, and we'll have borrowed nearly a trillion." Well, the net immigration that the Tories ran at 1.2 million, and the borrowing costs and the money printing went off the charts. So clearly, the last real threat to the hegemony was Corbyn. Now, I'm not a massive fan of Corbyn. I don't really like a lot of his politics, but he offered a genuine change. He offered something different. And his attacks on Zionism, his attacks on the power structure, he was simply prevented from being the next prime minister of this country. So how is change even possible? Even if you look at Farage is a safety valve. He's not offering change from a right-wing conservative perspective. He's a safety valve. So if you look at the way the British regime works, It manages to just stop anybody changing anything, whether it's from the left, from the right. Now, again, on to Thatcher. I wasn't a huge fan of Thatcher, but Thatcher was in many ways a revolutionary leader, and a lot of the British establishment didn't like her. I mean, obviously how it all turned out wasn't ideal. I just think you're just going to have this dull, boring, managerial class of politician who does nothing. And that's what Starmer is. Just like a bureaucrat, a man in a grey suit, or a woman in a fancy suit who'll impress you. The farmers are just too weak. They're nothing like their colleagues in Europe. And again, the problem with the farmers, Tony, I sympathise with them. I like them, but that rally they held, they had Kemi Badenoch, they had bloody Ed Davey. It was run by it was an Aster that was running it. It was just basically, oh, this isn't fair. We're going to have to pay too much inheritance tax. That's not going to get you sympathy from the public. The other problem the farmers face, Tony, whether they like it or not, is the big argument during the 80s was no miners, no coal. Well, you can buy coal from somewhere else. No shipyards, no ships. I mean, the way the world is now, you can just fly food in from abroad. So that the farmers really need to up their game and get the public on side and show that they are an intrinsic part and fibre of the country. I hope what might happen is just the whole system kind of collapses. That if the left could, because again, the mistake people make is they think Starmer is like a socialist. He isn't. Starmer represents Zionist neoliberalism and continuity of the existing order. So, I mean, again, Corbyn needs to grow a pair and actually go out and destroy the Labour Party. Maybe Farage can destroy the Tory Party. And then maybe in that chaos, genuine people can emerge and people who just aren't bought and paid for by foreign interests.
Can you maybe take us through some of your particular choices for news and for places to get news? I just think, you know, for so much of what I see rubbish, nonsense. I see a lot of just over the last week we've had whole segments of news about American weather and things like this. But where can we go to find out what's really going on?
Well, it's a tough one. I mean, I would always say, you know, go on alt media. I wouldn't look at anything on the television, GB News, ITV. I mean, I watch GB News, ITV, Sky, etc., but just realise it's all bought and paid for propaganda for special interests. You've got myself, you've got UK Column, of course you've got David Icke, you've got people like yourself, you've got citizen journalists. I would just say find people that will give you a rounded analysis of what's going on and just basically say, look, there is another. If ever the mainstream media says this is what is happening, always listen to someone says, well, this is the other side of what's going on. And whether it's any war, any conflict or anything that's ever happened, there is always two sides to the story. Now, I have my political opinions. I have my world views, and I don't lie about them, but I don't kind of lie to people into supporting my narrative. And that's what I think you want, is just people who are not bought and paid for by special interests. And like GB News is a good example of that. You know, the owner, Sir Paul Marshall, Marshall Wace, a hedge fund worth hundreds of millions. He's also buying The Spectator. Paul Marshall's wife is Jewish and a Zionist. His son, Winston Marshall, the Winston Marshall podcast, one of the biggest podcasts on YouTube. None of that stuff's organic. You know, this is all big money behind it, and it's all pushing an agenda. And like I say that, it's like I call out Ukraine, the Ukraine scam, NATO, Zionism, etc. You know, who's funding me? You know, because on the other hand, I'm not supportive of the Iranian regime or the Qataris. So you just need people that I think are not being bought and paid for. And again, use your discernment as to who you get your information from.
So how do people find and follow you? And what do you do regularly that people can tune into?
Well, I'm on Telegram, Twitter, at Unity Usenet. I do a live show 5 nights a week on Rumble and also DLive. And I mean, that is another thing as well I say to people. YouTube is, I mean, you're basically watching the CIA-approved version of events on YouTube. Try not to go on YouTube. You've got alternative platforms like Rumble, BitChute. Try and find people who are there. So I broadcast on DLive and Rumble 5 nights a week, and people can follow and tune in and listen then. And as I say, I don't ask people like me or even agree with me. I do welcome a debate. I do welcome a challenge. I do support free speech. And everyone's welcome to come and listen and hear what I have to say.
A couple of I'd like to add to your list, since we're at the beginning of 2025, to sort of do a little attempt, a bit of a definitive one, is Crispin Flintoff's show on a Sunday. And
Sonia Poulton's another person as well, does a show in the morning.
And and also Richie Allen.
Yeah. Is he still doing his shows, Richie Allen?
Yeah. Oh, he's back again. Yeah, I think so.
Back again. Yeah. I mean, look, there's lots of good people out there. And as I say, I would just recommend anybody who's kind of doing their own thing, or they're in a small independent network. That's look, it is a bit, this is the beauty of choice. You will find the right person there. But whatever you do, you know, anything, if you go on YouTube and Jordan Peterson flashes up in front of you or Ben Shapiro, they're there for a very specific reason. Don't click it. Go and search out for people.
Okay, finally, the accelerationists. I find this a fascinating subject, partly because I went to school with this guy who's the father of accelerationism, Nick Land, now out in Shanghai. But this is this idea that these crises are being deliberately created, and the so-called solutions to those crises are going to make things worse, and they are making things worse. The perfect example, I suppose, is COVID with the man-made virus, and then this vaccine that's extremely dangerous. So what do you make of them?
And what do you mean in terms of acceleration, that they want a collapse?
They seem to be trying to accelerate a global collapse and drag us into a World War III with the
I mean, I'm against that, of course. Like, I just think the system will collapse on its own. I mean, I do see my role, though, as a destabilizer. I mean, I believe in destabilizing the institutions of power and trust, because they're not to be trusted. But I'm not an anarchist. There's a big strain of that, like libertarian anarchism. I'm not into that. I just think the system will collapse in on itself eventually. But what I would hope for is perhaps an orderly transition back to something that is better. So no, I mean, I'm against war. But I'm against death. I don't want to see people dying.
Yeah, these people, they know exactly what they're doing. Seems to me that this is basically the biggest sort of conjunction of disaster capitalism ever seen. The idea is
I don't like that.
That they are going to control the outcome as there's this massive crisis, Armageddon, whatever you want to call it, that they're going to be the ones to bring everybody out. A bit like, I suppose, a bit like the economic disaster in Germany in the 1920s. You know, that's you've got Hitler saying, it's okay, everyone, I will sort things out.
Well, what I say is, if someone says to me, what's my politics? I mean, I just kind of believe in going back to the traditional way of things. I am quite traditional. I believe in family values. I believe in Christian values as well. And back to a more happy time and a more simplistic time. And again, as you say, the forces of capital, they are not on your side. And they've all got their bunkers in New Zealand or they've got their, they could go on a submarine somewhere. So yeah, I would be very wary of anybody pushing for war. I mean, I'm against war in general, because everybody dies. And then at the end of it, everyone turns around and says, well, what was that for? It's like all these dead bodies in Ukraine. I mean, I've got a friend that sends me the stuff over. I mean, he estimates it's probably over about 1 million dead between Ukraine and Russia. 1 million people dead for what? Dead for what? It's a disaster. I mean, I'm not a pacifist. There does come a time where you have to fight. But can we not be civilized and try and solve our problems? And if we're not able to solve it, we don't just... It's like you and I having an argument and then the next thing you know, we're battering each other. Like, civilized people don't behave like that.
No, they certainly don't. Anyway, David Clues, UNN, thanks very much for joining us.
Brilliant. Tony, thanks for your time.